Blog Talk Radio.
Is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie before us, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does this amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. Doing real good.
Happy Tuesday.
Up for another week of podcasting goodness. We're starting a little bit late on a Tuesday, but that's okay. We've done that before.
We promised three shows on Friday, and three shows we shall deliver. If we have to start, if we have to do three on Friday, we'll do three because that's how we roll. We're closing in. We're closing in on the big 500 for total lifetime podcast. This is actually 494 of the Fast Forward Radio / World Transformed combined series. So we're getting there. And I want to correct something that we talked about this a week or so ago, and I said that I wasn't counting our original shows. I actually did count those as 25. I counted the first 25 of those, plus everything we've done as Fast Forward Radio, and then now all the World Transformed.
I think that's being conservative. I honestly think there's a few more than that, but
There might be. There could well be, but they were few and far between because they were, if you recall, the hoops we used to jump through to do them, they were pretty tricky.
There's probably still people who do things this way. I would record my end of the conversation. You would record your end of the conversation, and we'd speak by way of phone. So we could hear each other, but we would record our own halves, and then we'd have to merge the two. It was labor intensive. This was,
if there's anyone still doing it that way, stop. Stop doing that. The cloud is there for you. There's so many better ways to do this.
Yeah, there are easier ways.
Yeah, you don't have to use Blog Talk Radio.
Well,
there's
freeconferencecall.com.
There's Skype. There's all kinds of options. Yeah.
Well, I think that if anyone's still doing it that way, it's probably just for purposes of maximum sound quality. You could, if you're recording locally, your own half of the conversation and then merging, I would expect you could have some
clear, great sound. I can see that. I would hope that even then there's some component in the cloud that's synchronizing both or somehow. I don't know. The idea of doing things locally and then merging them together, it just seems so primitive now, doesn't it? 11 years later,
there's just no way we could put out as many shows as we do, doing it the old way. I suppose if I did nothing else for a living, we could put out shows that way and keep it up at the same level we're doing now. But I'm very grateful for modern podcasting,
I feel technology has served us well. Absolutely,
That's right.
The way technology has moved around, but it took some ingenuity on our parts to do the show originally. And speaking of ingenuity, why that's our topic this evening, because we're going to talk about how new and bigger problems require new and better ways of thinking. And I just saw that it just says Thinke up there. I made a title so long that Blog Talk Radio can't handle it, so I'm going to have to modify that. But it's actually Thinking, not Thinke, which I don't know what that would even mean. Could have skipped the another fine mess, huh? Just new and bigger problems require new and better ways of thinking. Anyway, as we brainstorm the title of the show that we're already doing. So here's what I did, Stephen. I came up with a couple of big problems, and then I came up with some examples of how changing how we approach them fixes things. And then we've got just one example of how our thinking can change. So we're just going to dabble with this. Obviously, this is the kind of topic that we could do full-hour shows on for several weeks and only begin to touch it. But it's important. Why? The reason it's important is because, you know, I think in many ways we're getting better and better at handling the small stuff. But there are bigger problems that humanity ultimately has to face. There are survival issues, and I'm talking about extinction level event survival issues that we have to face. And a story that got my attention from last week was from our good buddy George Dvorsky over on Gizmodo. We'll only have a year to prepare for a cataclysmic super eruption. And wow. Actually, did you read this, Stephen? Did you see this piece? I'm sure you had a chance to look at it.
Yeah.
I was immediately kind of cheered by the, hey, we'll get a whole year. Because I've been picturing that, like, some night Yellowstone would just blow and, you know, I'd be dead the next morning, right? I wouldn't even know what hit us. I you know, if we have a whole year, I don't know if you ever remember the movie When Worlds Collide. It's an old 1950s science fiction movie about basically two planets are on their way on a collision course with Earth. There's a big one and a smaller one. The big one is going to hit Earth. The smaller one is very Earth-like and might assume an Earth-like orbit. So there's this whole, like, we've got to get off Earth and get on this other, you know, this other smaller planet because the big one's going to – but anyway, they have about a year to prepare, and so there's this mad scramble to you know, to save humanity, to build this rocket, to get there. And in the book, it's a really good book by Philip Wiley, the Americans aren't the only ones who make it. The Chinese make it, and there's some other groups trying to get to this other planet. But it's nothing like a year to really focus your attention. You know, it's like, okay, well, this thing, you know, this terrible thing is going to happen in a year. Certainly, if you have a year to plan, you can evacuate the area that's going to be blown up. I wonder though if we would be successful at doing that. What do you think?
I think you'd have holdouts, of course, and, you know, some, and, you know, if we were to learn that Yellowstone was going to blow, and that basically was going to make, you know, 2/3 of the United States uninhabitable, I don't think a year would be sufficient to evacuate everybody. I don't think that there'd be a lot of people that just wouldn't go. I think
logistically
it would be
enough time for everybody to leave, but would everybody go? That's the question.
Right.
You know, I mean, and where would they
that's
go?
That's the question.
Yeah,
exactly.
Because we're not just talking about Wyoming and Colorado. We're talking about basically this half of the country. You know, I mean that.
I've seen the maps. Basically, Shreveport would be marginal.
Yeah, exactly.
As to whether it would be livable or not.
From a
major Yellowstone eruption, and here's another thing to consider.
So we're coming your way,
Stephen,
because from Denver, marginal sounds pretty good. I got to tell you. Okay, so we're going to be
you're dealing with marginal. That'd be awesome. We'll keep the porch light on. But anyway,
please do.
But what I'm thinking is that even if you're not buried under 20 foot of ash, you got a serious problem worldwide, because in 1815, I believe it was, there was a major volcano, and the following year is known, 1816 is known as the year without a summer.
Right.
And there was widespread famine, and it was really a it was a tough time that following year, and that was just that eruption is nothing compared to what Yellowstone would be. I think Yellowstone would throw us into an ice age.
It might very well.
And
very well. So, you know, so when you think about this impending disaster,
big problem.
Yeah, it's a big problem, and it's not one that you really want to start working on when you get the year clock ticking down, right? In fact, by the time you've got the 1 year notice, you should already have been thinking about this quite a bit. Actually, that's the thing. The fact that we're not even within that year yet tells us this is a really good time for us to be thinking about this and thinking about what we have to think about. Because you make a good point. If we could get everybody out of the way, that would be great. Save as many lives as we possibly could. If we're really facing, you know, ecological or climate disaster, how we prepare for that? How do you prepare for an ice age? Is there any way to prepare for an ice age, right? You know, these are the kinds of questions you have to start pondering, right, to really prepare for this thing. You know, what do we do about the famine the next year? What do we do if an ice age sets in? And ultimately, it comes down to a more fundamental question, which is how would we prevent this from occurring, right? Is there some way to prevent the caldera from blowing up in the first place? Now, right now, that engineering doesn't exist. I mean, there is geoengineering. We have fracking, right? That's kind of our best example, probably, of geoengineering occurring in the world today. And, you know, this would be a problem that's a far cry from fracking to resolve this. You know, how you go in and stop this from happening.
And fracking might make it worse. You know, it might speed up the clock. It's hard to know how you deal with that, you know.
Right, but the thing you have to do is you have to start by asking questions you haven't asked. You have to start by thinking about solving problems you've never taken on before. You know, what do you do when an ice age hits? How do you move half the country to the other half? Right? How do you prevent an eruption that's been building for what, 1 million years, 3 million years, something like that? It's a long time. We're talking about very long-term geological processes that are playing out here. And our time scales are minuscule in comparison. But our ability to impact things, our ability to change things, is extremely rapid, and we can be very effective. So we have to begin by thinking that we might be able to do something. Part of our thinking has to be that this is not a completely intractable problem, that it's not unsolvable, that there has to be something that we can do. And we begin with that. Maybe we can move everybody. Maybe we can, store up food for a long winter. Maybe, you know, there are all these things we can do. And maybe there's something we can do to release that pressure in such a way that we don't get the big kablooey, right? Maybe we get something, but something not quite as bad as that. But anyway, those are examples of the kinds of thinking that we should be engaging in, not when the crisis occurs, but right now, right? People should be making these plans right now. This should be somewhere in the playbook, just as we should have a plan in place for what to do when a big meteor is on its way. We should have plans in place for what to do if a solar flare knocks out the electrical grid, right? Those kinds of problems. Those are possibilities that we know exist, and we should have plans in place. We should be building the resiliency to deal with those. I don't know that we're thinking about these in the way that we should.
Probably, the best known program that might actually help in a situation like this is what Elon Musk is trying to do. You know, colonize Mars. That's the ultimate. It's not have all of our eggs in one basket. You know, I mean, have a colony on Mars. It, you know, with sufficient genetic diversity, if not in the numbers of people that are there, then just have a database with the code for, you know, all the plants, animals, and a large portion of the population, so you could basically reboot the Earth when from the colony that, you know, coming back, you know, at some point. So that's I think that's part of the thinking of Elon Musk is, you know, if something bad were to happen, you know, either man-made or natural, it sure would be nice to have a sizable colony elsewhere.
And that's great. I mean, that's great for humanity, and we're all about humanity, obviously. And it's great for the people who go to Mars, but also, you know, anything we can do for those of us who are still here on Earth would also be greatly appreciated.
Would be much appreciated.
Yeah, would be would be fantastic. But I think you're right. That's one of the things you start thinking about is like, okay, well, if the unthinkable happens, if the total disaster occurs, how do we survive as a species, right? That's one of the questions you have to ask. And you're right, Elon Musk is thinking about that. Well, here's some other ways that we can address these kinds of problems. Here's a great story. Google cuts its giant electricity bill with DeepMind-powered AI. Now, work with me on this. This is really awesome. Okay, so what has Google done? They've taken their deep learning system, which we've talked about quite a bit over the last few months, all the interesting things that it can do, and they've put it in control of data centers around energy consumption, and they've established a significant savings in power just by letting this this machine learning system look at it and figure out optimized ways of doing it. So I think one of the ways that we can not only help out our environment and not only help out saving energy, but address big problems is to realize that we've got some significant firepower under development to help us solve problems if we turn the machines on the problems, right? The problem we start out with here, the volcano is going to blow, is a little outside of DeepMind's ability to deal with right now. But give it a few more generations of the software, right? And it might be coming up with things that that we wouldn't have thought of.
That's right. And these systems, they learn much as we do, in a sense, Phil. They're beginning to be able to take problems apart like we do and come up with unique solutions that, in some cases we would have never come up with. So that's exciting that we can turn these machines loose on problems like this and they come up with stuff. So yeah, it's interesting. We spoke about this even last week. How one thing that Google is doing with Translate is there's no human translator in the loop. When you use Google Translate, it just figures it out. It gets enough examples of the language in use. It teaches itself how to speak,
So, it's figuring out the rules of grammar, the vocabulary, syntax, all of it. It's figuring it out behind the scenes, and it is reverse engineering those languages as well as, you could reasonably expect a human being to do it, or at least it's closing in on that. And of course, ultimately, it's going to be much better at it than a human, without ever once any human really touching the process, without ever once any human saying, "No, this is the French word for cheese" or whatever, And that, what's interesting about that is, we don't have to slow these things down, right? For some of these problems, we can just kind of step out of the way and say, "Here, DeepMind, take a look at how we're using energy here. How can we fix that?" And you think about all kinds of other similar problems this could be applied to, economic problems. I think about things like traffic. I think about, things like agricultural management and the weather and shortages and all kinds of things that we have a really hard time reacting to and planning around and stuff like that. Start feeding the data points into DeepMind and see what it comes up with. Ultimately, I think it's going to have answers to problems, as you said, Stephen, that we would never have thought of because we just can't think that way. It has the advantage of being able to look at everything at the same time, which we don't get to do. We build these highly abstract models and we work from there. And I'm not down on human thinking, but it's great that there's kind of a supplement or an alternative now.
And, give you an example. Amazon has sort of the world's worst traveling salesman problem. I'm talking about it's in order to properly deliver as much as they're delivering, in order to optimize their resources to do so, they've got AI working on it. That's part of the secret of their success. They're so efficient, and that little brown box showing up 2 days, you can just about set your watch by it, after you
absolutely
order it. And overnight if you pay a little extra, right? So it's remarkable some of the problems that can be solved.
So that's part, I think that's part of the equation. Let's let the machines do the thinking for us. Now I've got a completely different part of the equation, which is if we start rethinking
right.
ourselves. And here we've got the site Meet Graham. This is from Australia. the only person designed to survive on our roads. And I gotta say, Stephen, this is a little outside the box, huh? You know, we've talked so many times about self-driving cars and how do you make cars safer and all that kind of thing. It's like, you know, have we been solving the wrong problem, right? I've often thought where child restraint systems are concerned that, you know, it's such a mess, you know, like installing these things. And I deal with three of them, right, at any one time. And we've finally gone from two car seats and one booster to three boosters, which was like, yes, a great moment of triumph in my life. But even the boosters are kind of a hassle. But you look at them and you go, okay, the fact that I have to keep, like, strapping these things into my car, you know, these weird, like, devices, says to me that probably the car seat itself and the car itself wasn't designed as well as it could have been in the first place. Okay, that's always been my, like, initial response to the car seat. I'm like, come on, you know, why do I have to do all this? Well, obviously, you have to do it all because the car was designed for people of a certain height and of a certain weight, and some people aren't of that height or weight, and you want to protect them as well. But here's reverse engineering from a completely different standpoint, isn't it? You know, what if what if we remade humans so they could survive a car crash? And if you follow the links to meetgraham.com.au, I think the first thing you'll say is, well, he's a handsome devil, but is he really going to, you know, is this guy really going to be able to survive a car crash better? I think if they were to engineer a human like this, he probably would. He'd be a lot more resilient, not only for a car crash, but all forms of trauma. I mean, the man's head is essentially a helmet, right? They've built what a great idea. Evolution, you know, has had a hard time coming up with this because imagine how, you know, if you got natural childbirth going on, how big the Graham's wife's hips would have to be to produce Graham's child, right? Because you look at the... Right. Yeah. I mean, you look at the size of this head. Why is his head so big? Well, his head's big because his skull is collapsible. His skull is like a bicycle helmet, right? It can move in a little bit and protect the brain inside. You know, the brain is deeply embedded. He's got he's got a completely redesigned rib sticking out there. He's got an extra joint in his leg for if he's standing on the road and a car's coming at him. One of the great things the designer says is. From my discussions, I learned that the neck was a real problem, so I just got rid of it, right? So the guy has no neck. Basically, he's got a rib cage and a head. He's got a head sitting on top of a rib cage. Okay, aesthetically, not great, but this is thinking outside the box, and, you know, it's like, well, I mean, would that be the solution?
The low back is a problem, too. I wonder, you know, did he say anything about the low back?
What do you mean?
When people get injured in automobile, and people get injured in automobile accidents, it's often the neck and the low back and then the brain and shoulders and knees and hips and that roughly that order. The neck is the worst. It is the worst. You tend to injure it faster than anything else. And so the elimination of the neck would do this guy would definitely help him in a car crash. Basically,
very
any,
good. Okay, so
sudden
so you also need a very different lower back, which I don't recall if.
Yeah. I don't know that he got to that in his design here. Yeah. The relatively rapid development of our species from something that wasn't walking on two legs to something that was. Has created low back problems for us. You know, adults. A sizable portion of people that are over the age of 40 have, a regular low back pain anyway. And then you apply
right.
an automobile accident to it, you're going to have low back problems. And that's an issue too. I wonder if what could be done about that. But anyway, you know. Like you say, handsome devil. I wonder how his wife would have to be designed to have children. I don't think this guy's going to have children. he's not a handsome guy at all. That's why I think you're much more like. It's an interesting it is an interesting mental exercise here. But I think what we're much more likely to see are cars that are designed just never to crash, and I think that's really what we're pushing towards with auto drive cars.
Yeah, I mean, we've worked on making cars that do less harm to us. Now, if we can just make them less likely to crash. I agree that that's probably a more straightforward way to go. Although the Graham experiment speaks to all kinds of things. It's like, well, you know, what if climate change is inevitable? You know, what if it?
What do we have to change?
I mean, eventually the climate's going to change, even if the caldera doesn't cause an ice age, or if global warming doesn't cause a massive heat wave. Eventually, the climate will change. Maybe we evolve ourselves by making ourselves more adaptable to whatever the new climate would be. Maybe Elon Musk's Mars settlers evolve themselves to be more resilient to the harsh conditions on Mars.
Lower gravity
Exactly. There's all kinds of possibilities. I don't think there's anything we can do to make ourselves caldera proof, right? I don't that would take a very well designed Graham, I think, to survive the big volcanic explosion. But to be more adaptable to a changing environment, to be more adaptable to an environment that otherwise would be hostile, you know, that is a possibility, and it's kind of the other big prong, right? So we can how do we address these problems? Well, we change our thinking. You know, we get the machines working on these things. Maybe we change ourselves, and then finally we come to the last one, Ray Kurzweil, get ready for hybrid thinking, and that's where you put it all together, right? It's where you say, well, we change ourselves.
Right.
We join with the machines. Here's this quote from Ray. 200 million years ago, our mammal ancestors developed a new brain feature, the neocortex. This stamp-sized piece of tissue wrapped around a brain the size of a walnut is the key to what humanity has become. Now, Ray suggests we should get ready for the next big leap in brain power as we tap into the computing power in the cloud. Well, I would go so far as to say that machine learning might already be like the next neocortex, but when you start creating an interface between human beings, between the human brain and artificial intelligence systems, that's going to be like another neocortex on top of that, right? We're standing at the threshold of one or two or who knows how many, three or four leaps as big as the introduction of the neocortex. And we can only hope that somewhere in one of those leaps is enough brain power to solve any problem we can currently imagine.
I mentioned how, you know, right now if you pull out your cell phone and you need access to computing power beyond what your little cell phone can give you, you know, you access that by way of the cloud. And he's saying that, you know, ultimately what we're going to be doing is have a direct access from our brain to a greater neocortex, a machine-based neocortex. If you need additional, you need to come up with something clever real fast, you'd have access to that, and that's a neat idea. It really is. And he says, you know, the neocortex, you know, the reason our skulls are shaped the way they are is to accommodate for that, the larger size. This new neocortex, you won't have to accommodate for it. The world, is to house this new neocortex for us. So
we don't have to become as ungainly as poor Graham. Who, by the way, I think he's got
Graham.
A great chance
to look
with the
like
ladies.
That's right. And you know,
as long
being
as
able to come up with something
right?
clever, that's right. That helps. That coming up with a perfect pickup line, right?
Exactly. Yeah. But exactly right. You know, the bottom line is we can increase that capability exponentially outside of ourselves, and as long as we continue to increase the interconnectedness between ourselves and that, our own progress is going to be equally exponential. Exponential in terms of how smart we become and exponential in terms of the severity of the problems that we can solve. And with that, can you believe it, we're already out of time. Stephen, that's how fast the time goes when we try to solve the big problems, isn't it?
That's right. This was a great show.
All right. Well, thank you all for being with us. Stephen, great talking with you. We'll be back again tomorrow with an amazing show. And until next time, live to see it.